There was a great popular applause. But Eginhard, the friend and biographer of Charlemagne, says that the new emperor was by no means pleased by this coup of Pope Leo's. If he'd known this was to happen, he said, he wouldn't have entered the church, great festival though it was. No doubt he'd been thinking and talking of making himself emperor, but he had evidently not intended that the Pope should make him emperor. He had some idea of marrying the Empress Irene, who at that time reigned in Constantinople, and so becoming monarch of both Eastern and Western empires. He was now obliged to accept the title in the manner that Leo III had adopted, as a gift from the Pope, and in a way that estranged Constantinople and secured the separation of Rome from the Byzantine Church. At first, Byzantium was unwilling to recognize the imperial title of Charlemagne, but in 810 a great disaster fell upon the Byzantine Empire. The pagan Bulgarians, under their prince Krum, 802-814, defeated and destroyed the armies of the emperor Nicephorus, whose skull became a drinking cup for Krum. The greater part of the Balkan Peninsula was conquered by these people. The Bulgarians and the English nations thus became established as political unities almost simultaneously. After this misfortune, Byzantium was in no position to dispute this revival of the empire in the West, and in 812 Charlemagne was formally recognized by Byzantine envoys as Emperor and Augustus. So the Empire of Rome, which had died at the hands of Odoacer in 476, rose again in 800 as the Holy Roman Empire. While its physical strength lay north of the Alps, the center of its idea was Rome. It was therefore from the beginning a divided thing of uncertain power, a claim and an argument, rather than a necessary reality. The German sword was always clattering over the Alps into Italy, and missions and legates toiling over in the reverse direction. But the Germans could never hold Italy permanently because they couldn't stand the malaria that the ruined, neglected, undrained country fostered. And in Rome, as well as in several other of the cities of Italy, there smouldered a more ancient tradition, the tradition of the aristocratic republic, hostile to both emperor and pope. Sixth, in spite of the fact that we have a life of him written by his contemporary Eginhard, the character and personality of Charlemagne are difficult to visualize. Eginhard lacks vividness. He tells many particulars, but not the particulars that make a man live again in the record. Charlemagne, he says, was a tall man, with a rather feeble voice, and he had bright eyes and a long nose. The top of his head was round, whatever that may mean, and his hair was white. He had a thick, rather short neck, and his belly too prominent. He wore a tunic with a silver border and gartered hose. He had a blue cloak, and was always girt with his sword, hilt and belt, being of gold and silver. He was evidently a man of great activity. One imagines him moving quickly, and his numerous love affairs didn't interfere at all with his incessant military and political labors. He had numerous wives and mistresses. He took much exercise, was fond of pomp and religious ceremonies, and gave generously. He was a man of very miscellaneous activity and great intellectual enterprise, and with a self-confidence that's rather suggestive of William II, the ex-German emperor, the last, perhaps forever, of this series of imitation Caesars in Europe, which Charlemagne began. The mental life that Eginhard records of him is interesting, because it not only gives glimpses of a curious character, but serves as a sample of the intellectuality of the time. He could read, probably. At meals he listened to music or reading, but we're told that he hadn't acquired the art of writing. He used to keep his writing book and tablets under his pillow, that when he had leisure he might practice his hand in forming letters, but he made little progress in an art begun too late in life. He had, however, a real respect for learning and a real desire for knowledge, and he did his utmost to attract men of learning to his court. Among others who came was Alcuin, a learned Englishman. All those learned men were, of course, clergymen, there being no other learned men, and naturally they gave a strongly clerical tinge to the information they imparted to their master. At his court, which was usually at Aix-la-Chapelle or Mayence, he maintained in the winter months a curious institution called his school, in which he and his erudite associates affected to lay aside all thoughts of worldly position, assumed names taken from the classical writers or from Holy Writ, and discoursed upon theology and literature. Charlemagne himself was David. He developed a considerable knowledge of theology, and it's to him that we must ascribe the addition of the words filioque to the Nicene Creed, an addition that finally split the Latin and Greek churches asunder. But it's more than doubtful if he had any such separation in mind. He wanted to add a word or so to the creed, just as the Emperor William II wanted to write operas and paint pictures, and he took up what was originally a Spanish innovation. Of his organization of his empire, there's little to be said here. He was far too restless and busy to consider the quality of his successor, or the condition of political stability, and the most noteworthy thing in this relationship is that he particularly schooled his son and successor, Louis the Pious, 814 to 840, to take the crown from the altar and crown himself. But Louis the Pious was too pious to adhere to those instructions when the Pope made an objection. The legislation of Charlemagne was greatly coloured by Bible reading. He knew his Bible well, as the times went, and it's characteristic of him that after he had been crowned emperor, he required every male subject above the age of 12 to renew his oath of allegiance and to undertake to be not simply a good subject but a good Christian. To refuse baptism and to retract after baptism were crimes, punishable by death. He did much to encourage architecture and imported many Italian architects, chiefly from Ravenna, to whom we owe many of the pleasant Byzantine buildings that still at Worms and Cologne and elsewhere delight the tourist in the Rhineland. He founded a number of cathedrals and monastic schools, did much to encourage the study of classical Latin, and was a distinguished amateur of church music. The possibility of his talking Latin and understanding Greek is open to discussion. Probably he talked French Latin. Frankish, however, was his habitual tongue. He made a collection of old German songs and tales, but these were destroyed by his successor, Louis the Pious, on account of their paganism. He corresponded with Harun al-Rashid, the Abbasid caliph at Baghdad, who wasn't perhaps the less friendly to him on account of his vigorous handling of the Umayyad Arabs in Spain. Gibbon supposes that this public correspondence was founded on vanity, and that their remote situation left no room for a competition of interest. But with the Byzantine Empire between them in the east, and the independent caliphate of Spain in the west, and a common danger in the Turks of the Great Plains, they had three very excellent reasons for cordiality. Harun al-Rashid, says Gibbon, sent Charlemagne by his ambassadors a splendid tent, a water clock, an elephant, and the keys of the Holy Sepulchre. The last item suggests that Charlemagne was to some extent regarded by the Saracen monarch as the protector of the Christians and Christian properties in his dominions. Some historians declare explicitly that there was a treaty to that effect. Seventh. The empire of Charlemagne didn't outlive his son and successor Louis the Pious. It fell apart into its main constituents. The Latinized Celtic and Frankish population of Gaul begins now to be recognizable as France, though this France was broken up into a number of dukedoms and principalities, often with no more than a nominal unity. The German-speaking peoples between the Rhine and the Slavs to the east similarly begin to develop an even more fragmentary imitation of Germany. When at length a real emperor reappears in Western Europe in 962, he isn't a Frank, but a Saxon. The conquered in Germany have become the masters. It's impossible here to trace the events of the 9th and 10th centuries in any detail, the alliances, the treacheries, the claims and acquisitions. Everywhere there was lawlessness, war, and a struggle for power. In 987, the nominal kingdom of France passed from the hands of the Carlovingians, the last descendants of Charlemagne, into the hands of Hugh Capet, who founded a new dynasty. Most of his alleged subordinates were in fact independent and willing to make war on the king at the slightest provocation. The dominions of the Duke of Normandy, for example, were more extensive and more powerful than the patrimony of Hugh Capet,